This episode is brought to you by our friends at PeopleBench and Paperly. PeopleBench specialise in helping schools build their collective workforce and retain their staff. We all know the future of work is fast, flexible and connected, and we also know the crunch for talented teachers is on our doorstep. PeopleBench are here to help you manage and plan your workforce with an intuitive platform that can provide all the data you need to make evidence-informed decisions about your next staff and workforce strategy. Head to peoplebench.com to learn more. Paperly is also back, and they're proud to support the Ed Leaders podcast. Paperly fills the gap in your traditional SIS or LMS and is designed to help your school create paperless, time-efficient systems. Check them out at paperly.education. Now let's get to today's show. Welcome to Ed Leaders, the podcast covering all the interesting ideas about leadership, strategy, culture, and the business of K-12 education, where we believe with better leaders, we'll make better schools. I'm your host, Luke Keller, and joining me each week in the chair is my co-host and colleague, Matthew Irving. Matthew, before we get started, you know the deal. I'm going to ask it. We send out a weekly email. What should someone expect?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, Luke. Often we call it the newsletter, but I kind of like to think of it as more of thought starters of the day. So if you're looking for something interesting, something different in your morning before you start work, I'd highly recommend subscribing to our weekly email.
Not bad, Matt. I'll give you a 6 out of 10 for that. You can sign up for the newsletter at edleaders.com.au. Now, on to today's guest, Dr. Adam Fraser. Dr. Adam Fraser is a peak performance researcher who helps people strive to achieve better performance in everything they do. His company conducts cutting-edge research with different universities all over the world, then disperses that information in a practical form through books, keynotes, workshops, training programs, online programs, and customized consulting projects. He's the founder of the Flourish Movement, a project that seeks to safeguard the well-being and fulfillment of current and future school principals. So he's talking our language here on Ed Leaders through research, longitudinal intervention, and group-based engagement. So without further ado, let's get to it. Dr. Adam, welcome to the show.
Hello, hello, hello. It's a pleasure to be here. Looking forward to it.
Excellent. Well, we'd love to start the show with a little bit about your personal and professional journey.
Wow. How long have you got?
You've got exactly 3 minutes.
Should this be a brief thing? So what are you specifically asking?
Just about the journey in your career, essentially, where you started, how you came to be where you are today.
Cool, yeah. Started out at university doing a computer engineering degree, which was the biggest mistake of my life. Hated it. Somehow passed, I don't know, but I did a year of that and then I kind of went, man, I can't go back, and started to think about what I really wanted to do. And then I changed to biomedical science, which is kind of a blend of psychology and physiology. So I studied that and then did quite well in that course and did an honors year, and then did some time at the Institute of Sport working with athletes. And from there, the university offered me a PhD scholarship. So I went down that road. And at the end, businesses started to ask me to come in and present to them on the stuff I was doing in my research, and kind of fell in love with presenting, fell in love with business. And from there, built a consultancy that runs workshops, large-scale interventions, does research with different universities. So that's kind of me. That's where I'm at right now.
And Adam, what does a typical week look like? I imagine it's not necessarily linear. There's lots of moving parts. Just describe a typical week for us.
Oh, yeah, there is no typical week. I mean, this week, I'm actually in monk mode, so I'm writing my latest book. So this week, I'm kind of at home on my own, just really immersing myself in that. Yeah, I also often I'm presenting, so I'm flying all over the place to present at conferences. That could be a keynote, could be a workshop, or gosh, last week I was in New Zealand working with the leadership team of a multi-billion-dollar company, working with the leaders about how they could be more cohesive, how they could work together, how could they improve the culture of the organization. So yeah, it's varied. And then, you know, I'm taking my kids to swimming lessons or gymnastics. Yeah, so it's all over the place.
I've often wondered, when people are writing a book, what does the actual day look like, and how many hours of a day, like when you're in writing mode or monk mode, as you described, what does that actually look like when you're sitting down to, I imagine, you know, at the typewriter?
Yeah, well, currently it looks like someone's had a fight with an office supplies company. I got post-it notes everywhere. I've got scraps of paper. So what I tend to do with the book is probably write it in my head for about a year before I start. And that's just have an idea or I have a concept and I start fleshing it out. Like I'll drop it in presentations to see how it's received, or I'll talk to people at conference dinners. And then once I feel that the idea needs a book behind it, I'll then start planning it out. So I use post-it notes to put up all my ideas, and then I start organizing them, and then I'll start writing bits, and then I'll go back to the post-it notes and go, oh no, that sucks, or that's not the flow, or this should come beforehand. So it's where I'm at right now is I'm writing content, but also rethinking structure of the book and how do I make the book palatable and really practical. So that's kind of the process for me.
And sitting behind your writing, Adam, is a clear, I guess, focus and energy and passion for working with leaders, whether it be in business, with education and the like. Sort of describe your why. What's driving you to do the work that you do?
Yeah, wow, that's a deep and very profound question. Inherently, I'm very interested in ideas and the shaping and sculpting of ideas so that they can become really tangible and practical. But I think my overarching why is I'm really interested in high performance. You know, how do we do what we do, but how do we do it better? But of late, particularly, I don't know whether it's just getting older, what I'm starting to be very interested in is how do I be a high performer, but without the collateral damage that normally comes with that? Because most high performers are a disaster. Most athletes, like the problem with them is they have to be incredibly selfish. Their whole world is about them. They're very inflexible. So that affects their relationships. I mean, most really high performers in organizations tend to have poor physical health. Their mental health suffers. They've usually had to compromise on relationships. So my why is like, how do I perform at a high level, but not like kind of leave this trail of destruction behind me? So that's my why. How do we get people to have balanced high performance, I guess?
It's an interesting concept. I mean, I've looked into this at a much lower level than probably yourself, but I'm always fascinated by, it's very easy to see high performance in athletes, whether it's their daily routine, it's their training, the way they eat, it's their nutrition, how much attention they pay to their sleep. And I feel as though, and there's tangible outcomes, it's whether it's winning a medal or it's a PB or it's averaging 25 points a game or whatever that looks like. It's very tangible, the outcomes that come from being necessarily what we might deem a high performance athlete. But when we transition that into the business world or in a school leadership context, the outcomes of that are much more difficult to see sometimes. And I'm not sure that necessarily that level of rigor that a high performance athlete goes to might also be the same for a high performance leader, although I think it is moving in that direction. Any thoughts on kind of that notion of high performance and how that moves across into the realm of leadership where things and outcomes are not necessarily as easy to define?
Yeah, gosh, there's so much in that. I think we have to be very careful about our comparison between sport and business. And business loves sporting analogies. They love, you know, high performance athletes coming along to a conference or, you know, a coach coming along. And there is definitely a lot we can learn for sure. But those two worlds are so incredibly different. Like sport, as you pointed out, is much simpler. There is one metric. Or, you know, there might be a couple of metrics like, you know, your power output or your VO2. But it comes down really to one number, which is whether the points we score in a game or whether it's the time that it takes for us to complete the activity. Whereas in business and particularly schools, it's far more complex. Like, I mean, with the Flourish movement, for the last 8 years, we've been studying in great detail school leaders. And I mean, you know, not just doing surveys on them, but getting them to fill out diary studies, interviewing them. Yeah, you know, we've looked at their world in great detail. And I think a school environment's one of the most complex environments you can ever come across. And the role of a school leader is so incredibly broad. Our research partner is Deakin University. And when we first started this project, they just went, I can't believe how broad this job is. Like, there's so many aspects to it. There's so many stakeholders I have to keep happy, whether it's parents, whether it's the board, whether it's the school community, you know, their staff. It's just so difficult. So I think It's fine to have sporting analogies and we can learn from them. But one thing we have to understand is that the complexity of a business environment or in particular school environment is huge.
And in the complexity of the kind of environment we're talking about, really curious around culture. You know, one of the things that we often talk about here on the podcast is culture. And I guess in your context, thinking about cultural settings that shape, that unlock and support high performance, what do those cultural settings look like in your perspective?
So when you say cultural settings, you mean what are some of the things we can do in the workplace?
I guess what are those foundations that need to exist in a workplace to support the shaping of high performance?
Oh, God, boys, you're hitting me with all these. We could spend 5 days talking about that question in itself. We do a lot of work on culture and particularly in schools and leadership teams. I think one of the biggest things we have to understand, and this is a piece of research we call the ripple effect. What we teach people is the dynamics of how groups work. And they're very complex. Actually, what we teach them is some research from the world of mathematics about how groups affect themselves and affect each other's behavior. And there's a couple of things we have to understand. Well, three big ones. Number one is that human behavior self-excites. And what I mean by that is that behavior is contagious. So if you do something, the chance of the people around you doing it dramatically increases. And we can see this when you're crossing the road and the red man's there and you're not supposed to walk, but there's no cars and you think, should I just go? And the guy next to you goes and then you all go. Like, we copy each other's behavior. The second thing is that small behaviors lead to big outcomes. So often I see in cultures and in leaders, they compromise on small things and they go, oh, that won't matter. Or they, you know, they do something that's not aligned to the values or isn't aligned to the strategy. And they think, oh, look, it's trivial. It won't have an impact. But down the line, it has a huge impact. And those little things that we compromise on, and this doesn't mean you have to be a like micromanaging psycho, but it's just, did I let someone get away with a behavior that wasn't congruent to our values then? Or did I compromise on something? Or did I hold myself to account? And when we let these little things slide, they compound and have a really big impact. Actually, here's an example. The principals that did flourish rang me and said, hey, I want you to come down and do a PD day with my staff on well-being, like, you know, particularly burnout. So I have a briefing with him and we're talking about the culture and he says, oh, you know, the culture's great. Our NAPLAN scores are incredible. Our staff retention's good. Like, he described this awesome school. And I said, are there any cultural issues? And he goes, oh, not really. Like, we have good staff retention. People don't tend to leave. And then as I'm hanging up, he goes, oh, there's just this us and them thing between the admin staff and the teaching staff where they see themselves as two separate groups and they don't really collaborate or come together. And I said, what do you think's driving that? And he goes, oh, I don't know. Like, I've been trying to work it out for years. I can't understand it. Anyway, I turn up, I'm doing the workshop, I'm meeting everyone, and everyone I meet is a teacher. And I said to him, like, where's the sort of admin staff team? And he goes, oh, I didn't invite them. And I'm like, what? He goes, oh, yeah, I didn't think to invite them. They're still working. And I went, I wonder where that us and them thing comes from. And he was a great guy and a great leader, and he cared about everyone in the school. But those little signs and symbols say a huge amount, because we're in this room laughing, having a great time, talking about, you know, how we look after ourselves. They're still out there working their guts out. So that's the second thing. And the third thing is to understand that every single person affects culture. So what our research with Deakin University shows is the biggest thing that stops cultural transformation is we outsource responsibility of culture to the most senior person. So we go, well, that's the principal's job or the APs or the DP or the executive team. They're in charge of that. They're in charge of culture, and not in a rude way, but just in a that ain't my job way. And what we've shown is that every single person in a group affects the culture of the group. And what each person has to think about is, how do I affect this workspace? How does my mood affect it? How does my behavior affect it? And so often people complain about the culture that they act in a way to reinforce. So I think they're the three big things: that human behavior is contagious, so people will copy what we do. Small things matter, and we shouldn't compromise on small things. And the last one is to understand that every single person has an influence on the culture of our school.
Certainly quite a few questions I could ask based on those three things. I guess one thing I want to ask there is about the small behaviors and working with your team to address those small behaviors or behaviors that are inconsistent with your culture or values. And I'm wondering whether with the principals and the leaders that you've worked with over your journey, whether there's an innate ability that some people just do that very well, you know, from a young age, or whether that skill of holding to account, I don't like using that terminology, but being able to kind of have the conversation in the moment gets better with age and maturity and experience.
Look, I think each of us have certain skills and talents and strengths. But one thing I definitely know is leadership is a skill and we can get better at it. And I've seen over 25 years, all sorts of leaders evolve and improve and really start to have a much more constructive impact on their school. But what it requires is self-awareness. And that is something that we really struggle with, the ability to be aware of our impact on other people. Yeah, obviously this is a complex thing because, well, as a leader, how often do we get feedback? Like, do our team actually give us feedback? Or are they scared of us so they kind of don't give us any form of feedback? So I think as we get older, we get more self-aware. I'd like to say we get less consumed by ego. We're more open to feedback. So I think the biggest thing about the skill of leadership and getting better is that self-awareness, that also humility. Like, what is so important is to be humble around, you know, I allow people to call me on my behavior. Or if I'm in a meeting and I act like a jerk afterwards, I apologize to people and I own it. So I think self-awareness, humility, but also creating an environment around you where you allow other people to call you on behavior creates such a healthy culture. Because if you're looking at a leadership team, say, you know, there's eight in the leadership team, and that has a dynamic where they are self-aware, where they think about their impact, they are humble, they do accept feedback, and also having environments that allow for feedback. This is something I've worked really hard in my organization to achieve, and my team feel very open to giving me feedback. And the other day, I was in a meeting and I was in a bad mood and someone had made a mistake and I brought it up four times in that meeting. Like, I kept going back to, yeah, but you did this. And my ops manager pulled me aside afterwards and said, hey, actually, I won't repeat what she said, but you were not very nice in that meeting. You have to apologize to that person and you have to own it. And as soon as she pulled me aside, I just went, I know what she's going to say. And I just said to her, like, you're absolutely right. I went, saw that person and I said, hey, that wasn't about you. That was about me. And I took it out on you and there's no excuse. I'm really sorry. And this is something I've seen not only myself, but other leaders is when you own your stuff and apologize and do better, man, that builds so much emotional capital. And I've seen some seriously senior big leaders do this. Gosh, it makes an impact. So that ability to take feedback, but also act on it and own it, I think that's so incredibly powerful.
And Adam, I
can't think of anyone giving you that feedback before, Matt.
Yeah, thanks, buddy. Appreciate that. Look,
there's a lot of love in this podcast, isn't there?
You know,
absolutely. I've told that once or twice. Let me tell you, Adam walked into his office and got Matt. He's like, I know what you're about to say.
Yep. Thank you in advance for your feedback. In all seriousness, yes. Adam, I'm really interested in that notion of self-awareness, humility, and feedback, and for a leader to actually own that and act on it the way you've just described it. And I can't help think that there are times where you'll go into an organization and you'll see a significant lack of that in a person, in a leader, and a significant gap. And I know for myself and my own work with leaders, we often see the deficiency, if you like, of those three ideas. What does it look like to journey with a leader to kind of unpack that and to point towards those three ideas? Is because actually it's going to make them better leaders and it's about their personal growth.
Yeah, it's a pretty challenging journey. It really is. It requires a lot of guts to go through that. And most leaders just don't have it. They just want to be told you're doing a great job and they just keep going. So it's a pretty scary ride. And if you have a lot of ego wrapped up in the position that you can't admit mistakes, that you can't be human, it's very difficult. But man, when you see someone do it, God, it's a beautiful thing. And you know, that capacity to really open up and evolve and improve has such a significant impact on the organization. And, you know, I'm working with a group at the moment, and as soon as I walked in the room, I just looked at this one guy and I went, oh man, you're going to be trouble. Because you could just tell he's just looking at, like, liquid hate is coming out his eyes. And he was the guy that shot down every idea. He was the guy that would always bring up what wasn't working and what wasn't going on. And, you know, it's even funny, like, your own thought process as the facilitator, and you just go, God, I wish this guy wasn't in the room. But I kept thinking to myself, like, if I win this guy over, like, I've got the group. But I also didn't want to suck up to him. So the first workshop was kind of, you know, I challenged him a couple of times, but also supported him a couple of times. And I just got to know him and know what drove him. And he was an incredibly wise, thoughtful leader. And his team loved him, like loved him. But when he came together with this group, he felt that this group was overly optimistic. They were delusional. They wouldn't have hard conversations. So he was having to go to the extreme. And what I did is work on that group dynamic where they started to see him as, you know, he's the black cap, or he's the realist that pulls us back. But also, yeah, one thing I said to him, and I said this in front of the group, is I said, you know, like, you're really awesome at that, but you've got to balance it out, because what we're missing out on is your ideas and your wisdom. And I watched this guy go from, like, he still pointed out, I think that's a problem, I don't agree. But he also went, oh, have you ever thought about this? Or have you ever considered that? And it was just, and he came alive. And in the first workshop, he barely spoke. And by the fourth one, he was the most vocal person in the group, but also the most energized. And he's throwing out solutions and ideas. And I think, yeah, he's one of the wisest people I've ever come across in terms of a leadership perspective. So, yeah, when it is a really hard journey, but when you see people evolve and improve, man, it's one of those great things. Similar, you know, with teachers, when that a kid gets it, like when it clicks, or when, you know, that kid that's emotionally unavailable starts to connect, it's that same feeling. So, yeah, look. To answer the question, it's a really hard journey and it's scary. Actually, it just popped inside my head, you know, that Empire Strikes Back scene where Luke goes into the tunnel and Vader's in there and he cuts his head off and it's Luke in the suit. And it's kind of that sort of journey of, I've got to get in the trenches and I've got to face some of the bad stuff about myself that I need to work on and realize.
When you're talking about behavior is contagious, I'm interested in what your opinion, having worked with 1,000 principles over your journey or more, how much impact can the one person have at the top of the organization in both a positive and negative way on the overall organization? Like, if you were to be able to quantify that, you know, in terms of how significant an impact that can have, by that leader showing either behaviors in one direction or the other that are contagious.
Yeah, look, so I'll put some caveats around this. Going back to my original point of everyone affects culture. So what we're not saying is here is that culture is only the role of the leader. It's everyone's role and everyone has an impact. But obviously, the most senior person in that group has the most significant influence on that group. So you could look at it and say that, well, the principal's behavior is the most contagious. And as you've said, like, we've had over 1,000 school leaders go through Flourish. And that is, it's an 18-month process. One term, they do the research. So we give them lots of time to do it so it doesn't become a chore. So we space it out. Then they do one workshop each term for 4 terms. And then we remeasure them at the end. And during that process, they also get support and coaching. So we get to know them very, very well. And yeah, they have such a dramatic influence. But coming back to the self-awareness piece, I think so many of them don't realize the influence they have or don't realize the impact they have. And that's something we teach them in Flourish, is around, like, how do you affect the mood of the school? How do you, like, what sort of standard do you set? What sort of culture do you create? And both in a positive way and a negative way, they have huge sway. I think if we were to boil it down, and this is something we talk about in Flourish, is, are you in alignment? So every school, every organization, every group has its vision, its values, its aspiration. So everyone's got that. But the really important question is, on a daily basis, do your actions, behaviors, and decisions actually align to what you say you stand for? And that's the hardest part. And this is the reason why organizations don't evolve. Because we say we stand for this, but we act in an incongruent way and it takes us in a different direction. You know, we say we give people autonomy and then we micromanage the crap out of them. Or we say try new things and take risks, but when someone makes a mistake, like we drag them across the coals and, you know, everyone in the school sees that and thinks, God, just whatever you do, don't screw up because you're going to cop it. Or even, you talk about, what's that?
Yeah, we mentioned it four times.
You're using my own stuff against me. This is not a safe environment. Yeah, I will bring it up ad nauseum. But I mean, if I look at myself, like I went, let's innovate and take risks. But when things would go wrong, I'd get all passive aggressive and sulky. Yeah, I would talk about the fact that we're all one team. But one of my staff pointed out, yeah, you say that, but you got favorites. And you know when someone gives you feedback and it like hits you right between the eyes and you're standing there wanting to argue and you go, oh my God, like I've got nothing. Like you've just nailed me. So it's all that sort of stuff. Or like, oh gosh, actually, I had a great one, right? And this is something I talk about in my presentations. Yeah, we do research with different universities all over the world. Like so that's our big positioning, is that the stuff I talk about in presentations has gone through a peer-reviewed process. Or with Flourish, like we get Deakin to independently measure the results. So we don't touch the results at all because, you know, bias can have a huge impact. So we're independent in that. So we get Deakin to do it. So we always talk about our university research, but the best material I get is drunk people at conference dinners. Man, like, and obviously I'm kind of at work, so I don't drink alcohol, but they do. And after about 10 glasses of wine, people come up and go, you want to really know what it's like to work here? And the truth comes out. But I presented at a principal's conference and I was at the conference dinner afterwards. And this woman comes up to me and she'd had like quite a few drinks. And she was lovely, but she came up and said, hey, you talk about performance and well-being and all that sort of stuff. And I'm like, yeah. She goes, I do all the stuff that people say you should do. Like I don't work excessive hours. I'm really effective. I don't work on the weekends. I exercise every day. I take a break at lunch. She said, I do all the stuff that my school encourages me to do around well-being, but they make fun of me every single day for doing it. She said, I walk out like, you know, on time and people would go, oh, nice to see someone can leave early or something like that. Or, you know, I might go for a walk at lunchtime and the jokes and the jibes. So she said, my principal stands up there and encourages people to look after themselves. I'm the only one doing it and I'm the butt of all the jokes. And that's grossly misaligned. Like we're talking about well-being, but we make fun of the people who actually do it. And what they're doing is killing a culture of well-being in their school. And what they're saying is we appreciate the people that overwork, that don't look after themselves, that are stressed out, that wear exhaustion as a badge of honor. So that's what I mean about alignment. We've got to ensure that as leaders, we're aligned to what we say we stand for. Yeah, that's kind of my soapbox on that one. Yeah.
Adam, I want to sort of now focus on that notion of well-being, and I've certainly seen you talk about well-being. And we often talk about schools being a reflection of society, and we know that we are sort of engrossed in this sort of this movement of well-being, if you like. You know, how do you best describe well-being, but also how do you best describe where perhaps our worldview's gone a little bit wrong when we talk about well-being in our organizations?
Oh, man, that is a great question. That's a great question because I've only just over the last 6 months started to really think about this. And here's where I think organizations go wrong. And sorry, Matt, you'll probably have to remind me of the first part in a second. But we talk about well-being, but we kind of put it off to the side in like a little box. And we go, here's our work and here's what we do on a daily basis. And we dip in and out of well-being. And well-being is, you know, I do a mindfulness course or I eat broccoli or, you know, it's these sort of habits. But what we found in our research is what improves well-being massively is, do I have clarity about my role? Like, do I get feedback on how I'm evolving? Do I have fun at work? Like, is it a playful, fun, safe environment? Do I feel like I'm making an impact? Do we take time to reflect on progress? Do we celebrate the victories? So what I'm finding is that we associate all these things with well-being, but we don't look at the way we work. And our data shows, man, if you get someone to feel like they're improving, that what they do matters on a daily basis, that they're appreciated, that they're safe in the group, and the group really has their back, that will do more for their well-being than any mindfulness course on the face of the earth. And that's where I think we've gone wrong, is we've separated well-being from the way we work. Like, one of the things in Flourish we do is we get them to fill out a diary study. So first of all, we get them to predict where their time goes, what percentage of their day is spent in different tasks and roles. And then we actually measure it. So in the diary study, they're prompted by their device to answer a series of questions periodically throughout the day for 10 days. And when we compare where they think their time goes and where it actually goes, on average, like, they underestimate how much admin they do by 200%. They overestimate how much leading they're doing by about 80%. So number one, they don't know where their time goes. But number two is most of their time is spent in tasks that they do not enjoy, that don't give them flow. That, like, because we also measure flow, which is that state where you're in the zone and you're just loving what you're doing and you're engrossed in it. You know, 44% of their day is spent doing the top four tasks that they hate the most. And 13% of their day is spent doing the tasks that they actually enjoy. So, like, if you could just re-engineer their jobs slightly, that they could be doing things that they really enjoy and care about, that's going to increase their well-being. Now, one of the other things we did with the diary study is measured interruptions, how many interruptions they have every day. The average school leader is interrupted 58 times a day, which works out to be, I think it's one every 6 or 7 minutes. So every 6 or 7 minutes on average, someone comes in or something comes in and takes you away from the task you're doing. Now, that cognitively, that is so exhausting, and that creates so much anxiety in their brains. So even just doing things like, and on average in Flourish, we see about around a 40% reduction in number of interruptions, because we get them to change the way they work to so that they get time to focus. And two of the biggest things is lower amount of interruptions and more bright spots in their day, like, which is the stuff they love doing. Man, those two things have a huge influence on well-being.
No, I'm sort of interested in those elements of sort of bright spots, if you like. They're the things that bring us joy.
Yeah.
They're the things that bring us that sense of fulfillment at the end of the day. But is there a falsehood in there somewhere that actually sometimes it's just really, really hard being a leader, and that actually we can't feel joy and fulfillment all the time?
Oh, totally. Totally. And we're not being delusional here. This is not about skipping through fields in a, you know, white linen and, you know, a stranger is just a friend I haven't met yet. You know, it's not that sort of delusional day. But in a day, can I engineer and drop in some bright spots? And it's what we found is for every leader, it's slightly different. For some leaders, it's coaching of staff. For some leaders, it's working on research around innovation in the way they teach, or any sort of innovation in the way they run the school. For some, it can be just visiting classes. Well, I was talking to one principal who now plays handball in the yard with, you know, some of the kids at lunchtime. So it's very personal. Or even it's just, I'm going to carve out an hour of the day where I get to sit and focus and work on things that I've been trying to get to. So the bright spots piece is much more about, here's what lights me up and energizes me in the role, and can I sprinkle a couple of those across the week? Because one thing we also measure is mood and energy levels. So for educational leaders, mood and energy starts highest at the start of the day, and then it drops off really quickly because most of the day is spent doing things that drain them. And it's just, well, what we get them to do is drop a few of these into their day. And yeah, some days there's going to be times where you can't fit them in, or you have a critical incident or something goes wrong. But it's about looking for that joy and that interaction that, yeah, re-energizes them and gives them a lift in their day and reminds them of why they do the job. But as you said, Matt, one thing we have to understand is that leadership is incredibly hard, and we're going to have hard days and hard conversations, and we're going to upset people. So it's not about avoiding those things, but it's about how do I balance this out?
As a leader of a school, you're probably aware that on average, around 80% of the cost of running a school is the salaries and on-costs of its workforce. And yet most schools do not have a comprehensive visibility of their workforce data and metrics. That's where people bench excel through their painted in school workforce benchmarking and strategy development platform. They use data science, machine learning, and predictive analytics to provide insights and resources that support school leaders to become self-sufficient in responding to the future of work in schools. The platform can benchmark your workforce data to other like schools, build your workforce strategy, and monitor progress on metrics like teacher resilience and workforce culture, while keeping an eye on how these factors impact student outcomes. A PeopleBench subscription provides your school or system with access to their school workforce research, school workforce benchmarking tools, dashboards and reports, workforce resilience tracker, their workforce culture tracker, their workforce strategy tracker, and much, much more. Check them out at peoplebench.com. I've got a question for you. How many paper processes does your school have? Well, that's where Paperly comes in. Paperly is an integrated one-stop shop of intelligent workflows that can help your staff save time and reduce that administrative burden that we know exists in schools and we all face on a daily basis. They're a completely modular admin management solution, meaning you just choose whichever of the 16 super useful modules that your school needs. My personal favorite that we use is their calendar module, which makes the administration of the school calendar so much easier. Check out paperly.education today and chat with the team about a demo for your school. Now back to today's show. Adam, I was at a conference yesterday speaking. I talked about the start of this podcast, like the start of the journey of this podcast, and pressing the publish button and kind of putting it out for the first time on LinkedIn. And we had 5 listeners in the first month. And I was talking to the audience about how scary that was. Like the discomfort for me and Matt, by extension, of pressing the publish button and producing something that was going to be out there for anyone to kind of listen to was really...
And judge.
And like all of those things. But it was a very, like the feeling at the time, even though, you know, like 80 episodes later, it's not like that now. But there's a real discomfort in the feeling of that moment. And I'm interested in your perceptions or what research you've done around it's okay to feel that discomfort. Like great things can come from feeling discomfort, feeling the fear of doing something and doing it anyway. And how as a societal shift, we, you know, it seems that we've kind of gone so far down this, got to feel good, got to feel happy, got to feel content all the time, that sometimes that is constricting us from progressing as either an individual or as an organization.
Collective, yeah. We were talking about the book writing process. At the start of 2020, I released a book called Strive, and the tagline was Embracing the Gift of Struggle. And what it talks about is this very issue, is that we have a society now where we demonize negative emotion. So this has come from motivational speakers who tell us, you know, we should be confident and we should have positive thoughts. The happiness movement that has said negative emotion, you know, positive emotion is good and good for you, negative emotion, bad and bad for you. And what we've had over the last 15 years is this stream or a narrative in society that we demonize negative states and we say that they're bad and we shouldn't experience them. Now, parents have picked that up and gone, well, okay, if negative emotion is bad for my child, how do I stop them experiencing that in any way? And this whole message has really done our society a disservice. And we're losing the capacity to sit with discomfort, exactly what you said before. You know, one of the biggest pieces of feedback I get from teachers is kids won't take risks anymore. They won't try things. If they don't get it the first time, they start to withdraw. And what the book Strive is about is how important being uncomfortable is. But we're almost trying to engineer it out of our lives. And it's very dangerous because most of our personal growth comes from discomfort. You know, you think about a teacher's whole focus is to get the kids to fail, you know, to try things and they don't work out. But then it's about, well, how do I support you and guide you through that learning process? It's kind of like James Nottingham's The Learning Pit. You know, you have to go into discomfort. So yeah, I mean, it's something I see in schools, in organizations, in society, that we are running away from any form of discomfort, or we see it as a bad thing. It's even, you know, you can't even have a debate anymore where you challenge someone and make them uncomfortable. They call it an attack, or that you're insensitive. Yeah, it's really chronic. And one of the things I do in my presentations is ask people to articulate what are they most proud of. So they've got to, with someone in the room, articulate, if they think about their whole life, what are they most proud of? And you know, the caveat is you can't use your kids as an example. Like, it has to be about you. And what comes up is things like, you know, I ran a marathon, or I left a dysfunctional relationship, or I changed careers, or I studied while I was working. One, I was in Kuwait doing a presentation over there, and I asked this question, and a woman put up a hand and said, oh, I got kidnapped by the Taliban. I'm like, what? And she goes, yeah, I got kidnapped, but the car had to stop. And she said, I elbowed the guy next to me in the face, and I grabbed the other guy and hit him in the face with his gun and then ran. Then she said, I fought him off and took off. And I'm like, I didn't really expect that one to come up. But what comes up is always like the hardest thing people have done. What they're proud of is the stuff they have to get in the trenches. They fight it out. They crawl out the other side. They look back and go, that's what I'm hanging my hat on. Like, I'm proud of. But it requires us to go through immense discomfort, immense. And I worry how far down this track we're going. And even having had numerous staff over the years, there's two people that work for me at the moment, both immigrants who, you know, had really hard upbringings. One of them was born in Portugal and, you know, grew up in a poor family, had to really struggle throughout her life. And she is a weapon. Like, she is unbelievable. She's so courageous. She'll take things on. Her work ethic is amazing. Someone we've just hired. Like, and we didn't even know this about her when we hired her. She's been working with us for months before we found this out. Was born in Afghanistan, moved to Pakistan at 20 days old because war broke out. So she moves to this country. Her dad goes back to try and get some of their things. He's killed in the war. Her mum is raising 5 kids on her own. And they're sort of fleeing all over the world from these atrocities that they're trying to get away from. And this girl's capacity to, like, for you to give her feedback and her not be offended, for her to try new things and give it everything she's got. And I compare them to other people that have worked for us who, you know, the smallest thing will just crumble. So, you know, obviously we don't want to go through trauma, but what we know is that people who have gone through hard stuff in their life tend to be much more resilient. So just to preface this, obviously we don't want to put people in areas of trauma, but what we know is struggle makes us tougher.
And Adam, is there a danger in this notion of growth that it becomes a little bit like the happiness movement, that we expect out of discomfort that we're always going to grow? It's sort of a danger that it'll become a sort of a deficit sort of concept.
Yeah, where we go the other extreme. Oh, I hope not. But I just find as humans, we always go to extremes. Like, even if you look at the dieting world, you know, it was fat is terrible for us, so don't eat fat at all. And then it's like carbohydrates are terrible. Don't eat carbs. You know, have as much fat as you want. We just go to these, like, the pendulum just swings so far the other way. And I think what happened with positive psychology is Marty's intent was not to go that extreme. And he even articulated this of, you know, we've taken it too far. We've got to find that balance. So I think what it is in organizations is that healthy balance between talking about how we're growing and evolving, as well as still having hard conversations and pointing out where the deficit is or where we're struggling. So, I mean, what I try and do in my organization is we have a very open feedback culture. But one of the reasons we can do that is we also have a real open praise culture where we talk about how people have gotten better. And we call them active constructive conversations, where you go into detail about, man, like, listening to you on the phone with that client, that was amazing. and I thought you handled this really well. Here's the growth I've seen. You know, a month ago, you couldn't have had that conversation. You're asking more sophisticated questions, like going into detail about it. So we have those conversations a lot, but we also have the hard conversations of, hey, the way you worded that email, that's not cool. Like, that's not in our tone, or you could improve that, or we expect more of you in this area. So it is about finding that healthy balance between those two things.
All right. Well, the last question we do like to ask before we get to my favorite segment, the 6 and 60 seconds, is about the crystal ball. We like to kind of get the crystal ball out and kind of ask our guests about what the future of school or the future of school leadership or the future of principalship, you know, might look like in the next 10 years. Any thoughts?
I mean, this is something I talked about at the HESA conference, was we've got to be careful about looking too far forward because we're terrible at it in terms of our ability to predict. You know, even I've seen so many presentations on AI, but very few of them are tangible about what probably Adam Spencer has been the best one, where most of the presentations on AI are just like these big mega trends and they're trying to freak people out. But Adam's was much more about, here's how I see it playing a role in education. It was very practical. So my predictions are, well, maybe I don't have any predictions. I think the reality is, just our Flourish research shows, you know, the levels of fatigue and burnout are high, but there is so much we can do about it. And what we see is our results really, like if principals are given support and resources and agency, they can really make a difference to reduce that burnout and to really fall in love with the job again. I think obviously the scariest thing is teacher supply and whether that becomes, does school start to go online? I'm working with a group, Cairns School, it's not School of the Air, but it's a similar concept where all their teaching is remote, but these people are so incredibly skilled and masterful at doing it. They're starting to run classes for schools in Sydney where they can't find it. Say they're trying to learn Indonesian and they can't find an Indonesian teacher. What they're doing is tapping into this school. So I think it's going to be mixed models of, it's not just going to be face-to-face. Part of it's going to be remote learning. Maybe there's an AI bot that they create that goes through the educational journey with a child and tailors things and learns how that child learns best, and almost like that AI is like a little tutor that helps them move forward. Like, I think there could be crazy changes in the model of education like that. One of the things I'm seeing that's really, really interesting is schools mostly work on sweat equity in terms of people go above and beyond. So you think about the average principal now, like half their arm could be hanging off. They would show up to work. Like, you know, they're so dedicated, and that's a double-edged sword. It's great because that meaning and purpose makes them very focused and engaged, but also, you know, they push themselves way beyond what they should be doing. However, all the school leaders I'm talking to right now are saying my staff's attitude has changed in that I don't want to go the extra mile. I don't want to attend that thing after work because I'm exhausted, or I'm not going to sit up and correct papers all night. And I think what's going to be really interesting is when we've lost all those people that would drive themselves into the ground for the kids. And what we're left with, and I'm not saying this is right or wrong, this is just an observation. What we're left with is a group that prioritize themselves before the job. So I don't know how that model is going to work when you don't have a group of people who will just crawl across broken glass for those kids. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The challenges of the society that we now live in is that we are moving, you know, students graduating are moving more and more towards, you know, thinking about themselves first and their own well-being first, because that's kind of what we've been teaching them for the last, you know, 10 or 12 years before they get to the workforce. So I think that's a pretty significant challenge.
And also a lot of teachers I'm speaking to are going, well, my partner gets to work from home, so why don't I get to work from home? Like, I'd love to work from home 1 or 2 days a week. And they're really almost resentful of, all these other people do, well, why can't I? Obviously, right now, we're not set up for that, but that's their expectation moving forward.
All right. Well, that brings us to my favorite segment, 6 in 60 seconds. It's one word or idea is the goal here. I give everyone a little grade at the end, depending on how well they've followed the rules, because generally, no one follows the rules. So we'll see how you go. You ready?
What are the rules? Just one word.
Idea.
Okay, all right.
All right. One educational narrative that's been underrated or overrated in the past decade.
I think growth mindset has been overrated.
One underrated role in a school or your own organization.
Oh, geez. I think, you know, in terms of office staff, admin staff, like, man, they're amazing. And they, yeah, I think them.
The most interesting professional development or professional learning that you've ever done?
Spent 3 days with Brené Brown.
If you could change one rule or one thing in education, what would it be?
That people in the department had to act in alignment to, does their activity have a tangible impact on students in schools?
One book worth reading?
Oh, 4,000 Weeks by Oliver Berkman.
Well played, you. I thought you were going to recommend your own, but that's okay. Well played. One person we should interview on the podcast.
One person you should interview. Simon Breakspear.
All right. I reckon that you've done pretty well there. I'm going to give that 9.5 out of 10. Well played. Actually, no, I'm going to ram that up to 10 out of 10. You followed the rules, didn't elaborate on any answers. Well done.
Perfect.
So,
what a way to start my day. 10 out of 10. I'm going to call my wife.
Exactly. Bring you a little bit of joy and a bit of happiness there.
That's my bright spot.
Your bright spot for the day. 10 out of 10. Well played.
Yeah.
Well, that brings an end to our show for today. I hope you've enjoyed our little chat with Dr. Adam. Matt, closing comments. Hit us with them. I know you've got them.
Well, I really enjoyed the sort of discussion we had around leadership, self-awareness, humility, feedback, and that ownership of self, I think was really important. Really liked the notion of the small things impact culture, and it's everyone's responsibility, and it's a great reminder to not only leaders but also to sort of teachers and other staff members in our schools. Really liked that idea of well-being and the focus on, do I have clarity in my role? And just that one thing, that foundational thing, has a significant impact on people's well-being. And I think engineering bright spots, you know, I think that's a really practical piece to take away from our discussion today. Luke, what have you got?
A couple of similar ones. You know, I also love that nature of it's everyone's responsibility, not just the people in the ivory tower at the top in the leadership roles when it comes to culture. And it is those small things. And I know I've kind of been over the last few weeks trying to reflect. I've watched a lot of Ted Lasso over the last few months, and what would Ted do in these situations? And, you know, it's those small things along the journey that really make the difference. And I think the effects of those small things and how you relate that to, yes, those things are contagious. And I think that, you know, that entire show is an example of how those little things that he does and that leaders can do are contagious to the community and the organization that they're building and the culture that they're building around them. So I love that aspect. The other bit is just the bright spots. You know, I do think that anyone in an organization don't necessarily just have to be the principal or in the leadership team, but everyone's got to make time for those bright spots. And I love that example of, if you love playing handball, go out and have a game of handball once a week. You know, find the time for that 20 minutes to find some joy, you know, on a regular basis of the things that you that are going to light you up. And also, you know, of course, that self-awareness and trying to continue to develop that self-awareness. I think it's an ever growing, ever changing and ever kind of evolving landscape of your own awareness. And as you grow as a leader, some of that awareness has to shift and change, and creating a culture where those people that work closest with you can walk into your office and go, you know how that came across? Not so good. And I think to your point, I'm not sure that every principal has enough of those people around them on a daily basis that is giving them that candid feedback in an honest and transparent way, in a manner that's actually about making that leader better. It's coming from a really good place, a really honest place to say, I want to see you be great. Here's some feedback to help you be great. And I think that's a really interesting notion. So that's my feedback on my closing comments, Matt. Adam, any closing comments from you? Anything you'd like to leave the audience with, where they can find you? Any closing advice?
I think just what I'd like to say is, from doing this project, I just have immense respect for educators. I think it's such a challenging job, but one that requires so many skills and sophistication. So just that admiration. In terms of me, you can go to my website, dradamfraser.com, or just Google the Flourish Movement. That will take you to that website. If you're interested in doing that program, by all means, get in contact with us.
Well, Thank you so much for giving up your time to be on the podcast. I know that Matt and I super appreciate it, and I know the audience will too. And for the audience out there, if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show and tell the person that is responsible for your next maybe professional development day or anyone that's interested in how they can affect culture in their school particularly, that they should listen to this episode of Ed Leaders. As I mentioned at the top of the show, you should sign up for the Ed Leaders newsletter. Check out edleaders.com.au for more details. And I'd like to give a special shout out to our sponsors of today's show. You would have heard us talk about them through the middle. We'd be grateful to help us make this show free for you if you could check them out and spend a few minutes supporting them as they support us. You can connect with Ed Leaders both on LinkedIn and Matt and I on LinkedIn, where we'll keep you up to date with all the latest. Thanks again for listening, and we will catch you next week.
Go well.